Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I am joined by my amazing host today. I have the amazing Sam Mazur. Say hi, bud.
Hey.
And our producer, our first-time producer, Olivia Baggett.
Hello.
All right. So tonight we have a wonderful guest, Dr. Jessica Madul, to discuss all things allergy. But first, Sam, remind us what the show is about.
Absolutely, Chris. Sorry, everybody. I'm playing with an injured voice tonight, but we're still going through. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Jessica Madul. Dr. Jessica Madul is the director of the Burkhart Food Allergy Center at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. She's very proud to have completed her medical education, residency, and allergy and immunology fellowship training at UNC Chapel Hill. Her clinical and research interests include food allergy prevention, treatment, and education. During her fellowship training, she was awarded a grant from the Allergist Foundation for her research on transitions of care of adolescent and young adults with food allergy, and plans to continue this work at OHSU. She has also recently started the food immunotherapy program at OHSU with the goal to provide both oral and sublingual immunotherapy options to food allergy patients in the Pacific Northwest. Dr. Madul teaches us at what age a child can develop seasonal allergies, how to look out for and counsel patients about food allergies, and when to worry about that tricky amoxicillin rash.
Gosh, I really do think that our listeners are really going to enjoy this. I learned a lot. What do you think, Olivia?
I just wanted to say thank you for choosing to be here.
Oh, high five, high five.
Well, hello, Dr. Jessica Madul. Thanks for coming on the show. We're sort of an informal group. Is it okay if we call you Jess? Is that okay?
Yeah. Yes, of course.
Excellent, excellent. Since you're new to our show, I was wondering if we could just start to, if you could give us like a little get to know you know, one or two sentences about who you are, maybe something outside of medicine that you really enjoy.
Yes, perfect. So I'm a pediatric allergist at Oregon Health and Science University, but I moved here from North Carolina just last year with my husband and dog, Izzy. I love hiking, finding the best brunch places because I love a good Bloody Mary, and I'm obsessed with true crime, and my favorite podcast is My Favorite Murder. Highly recommend.
Well, what's that? Have you seen that Hulu series, Only Murders in the Building? Is that what it's called? Where they?
No, I haven't, but multiple people have recommended it to me.
Well, it's like, is it Martin
Selena
Short,
Gomez. Yes.
Selena Gomez, Martin Short, and Steve Martin. And they're like, they love crime podcasts. And then at least in the first season, like there's a death in the building. And then they start building their own podcast out of it. It's just sort of funny.
That would be a dream. I would build my own true crime podcast. Amazing.
Well, there you go. It's the pick of the week. Chris, we just accidentally did picks of the week. This is perfect.
Ooh, join
the
show notes.
Everyone can see it. Exactly. Exactly. Sorry, I stole that thunder. Olivia, you want to ask another question?
Yeah. What is the best advice that you've ever received as a learner, as a teacher, or in your career?
So as a learner, I think the best advice I got from attendings was it's okay to be wrong. I think when we're going through medical training, we're all very type A. That's how we got to medical school in the first place. And you want to be perfect and you want to say all the right things and make all the right plans and never be wrong on rounds. And I just had to let that go. And as long as you have your evidence-based medicine you looked at and you have some reasonable approach to why you did that plan, you've won. I feel like that's a learning experience. You just take it, learn from it, and it's okay. Let it go. And so that's the best from learner. Do you want me to answer all of them as a teacher?
No.
Whatever
works best for you. If you have a couple other ones, we'd be more than happy to take those.
Well, I will say in my career, because I'm a people pleaser and I'm trying to get out of that, it's okay to say no. So it's okay to say something doesn't fit into or benefit your career, and it's okay to turn down those opportunities to keep yourself sane. And I am learning the word no, and it's very hard. So learn it early.
Yes. I love it. I love it. And that's starting to be some advice that we're getting over different from different guests at different times too, that it's okay to say no. I will say, and this is something that I, you know, have also passed on a little bit to learn, and not that this is my advice or anything like that, but the getting things wrong, totally okay to be wrong. I love the idea of like, I have no idea what's going on, but this is what I'm going to do if that fails, you know? So it's like, here's some fluid and I know how to take it away if that was totally wrong, you know? So if you come up with a backup plan, you feel like, oh, at least I'm totally cool if I get something wrong. I know exactly what I can do next. Yeah. You know, it's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like good modeling too. I think when residents and learners and students, they see their attending, you know, if they do get it wrong and they admit it and say, like, it happens, we get it wrong, and they're able, and you're able to like say, we learned from this. I think that's also great behavior to show to them. Then they don't have that stress as well. So,
who's ready to optimize their nutrition this year? Factor's here to help you, Cribsiders listeners. Factor has chef-made gourmet meals that make eating well easy. They're dietitian approved and ready to heat and eat in 2 minutes, so you can feel right and feel great no matter what life throws at you. Whether it's too much time in the hospital or too little time between after-school activities, Factor will help you. Their meals arrive fresh and fully prepared, perfect for the busy lifestyle we all lead. With 40 options across 8 dietary preferences on the menu each week, it's easy to pick meals tailored to your goals. Choose from preferences like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, or Keto. At home, we use the vegan and veggie option and couldn't be happier. Eating vegetable forward has really helped us achieve our goals this last year. Factor can also help you feel your best all day long with wholesome smoothies, breakfasts, grab-and-go snacks, and more add-ons. So reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. Eat smart with Factor. Get started at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off your first box plus free shipping. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box.
All right. I think that's great. Should we start just jumping into it? Because I think we have a lot to talk about allergies in our pediatric population, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's jump into it. So we're going to start with the first case. So you are seeing baby Poppy Pollen for the first time. She's a 6-month-old healthy girl. Parents are bringing her in today because she's been sneezing more frequently and seems to be rubbing her eyes more lately. The family suspects seasonal allergies and would like to discuss treatment. So being in the outpatient setting, this is a situation that I get all the time. So we talk about allergies all the time. I know they're immune mediated, but can you briefly tell us more about the common categories of allergies and maybe the different type of immune responses at play?
Yeah, so the most frequent different types of allergies or allergic conditions that I see in the pediatric population are kind of broken down into categories, right? So there's one food allergy, which is my passion and what I see a ton of in my clinic. But you also have allergic rhinitis that could be seasonal or non-seasonal. Both of those things are going to be mostly IgE mediated, but sometimes you can have a non-IgE mediated food allergy or something else like non-allergic rhinitis going on. Asthma is a big condition in kiddos, and it can have could be allergic asthma or it could be nothing to do with allergies. And then you can have eczema as well. And so that can be a mixed picture of IgE mediated and non-IgE mediated processes. So it's a kind of wide array that we see.
And for the IgE versus non-IgE, you know, I remember in medical school, we learned about these 4 types of hypersensitivity reactions. Is that something that you think of as you're an actual allergist, or is that something that we just learned first or second year and call it quits?
No, that's a great question. I mostly think about it in this thinking about drug allergy. So if I'm thinking about drug hypersensitivities and I'm trying to break it down into a category, I'm looking at those different types, and we do truly still use those. And we'll talk about those probably today. But when it comes to like food allergy, I'm really thinking broadly in 2 categories of, is this IgE mediated or is this possibly not IgE mediated? Meaning maybe we don't know the true mechanism of what's going on, but for example, FPIs or food protein induced enterocolitis. But yeah, we still use those types, all 4 types, just in drug allergy mostly.
All right, everybody, stay tuned. We're going to start talking about them later on.
And so you touched a little bit about allergic rhinitis versus seasonal allergies. Can you touch a little bit about the difference between those and if there is a utility in making the distinction for families?
Yeah. So when I see a kid, and I feel like it's a very common referral that we'll get to the allergy clinic where we're seeing somebody who's younger than 2 years old or even maybe younger than 1 year old, they're coming in concerned for seasonal allergies because they're having persistent runny nose or they're having persistent nasal congestion or there's something else going on. And I talk to them about the fact for seasonal allergic rhinitis. So this is where we're talking about pollens, right? So trees, weeds, grasses that are affecting, we're really not going to see those until 3 or 4 years of age. And the reason is because you need to be exposed to those pollens over several years before you're becoming sensitized or clinically allergic. And so a lot of times I'll tell parents very, very unlikely that a seasonal allergy is causing symptoms. It's possible that a perennial allergy, so something like dust mite, cat, dog dander, cockroach even, or even molds that are in the house all the time could potentially cause sensitization earlier in issues. So I'm willing to do a little testing there, but I try to avoid the seasonal allergy testing until a little bit later on. And parents typically are okay with that. And they're like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, I get that, but we do have a dog. So could we test a dog? And then I'll test a dog.
Can you discuss a little bit more about what you mean by testing? Because, you know, I've heard a lot of different types of tests out there. You know, I remember when I was a resident, you know, I rotated with an allergist and they did all sorts of things on kids' backs and arms. They do a lot of pricking and stuff like that. But also know that, you know, I've seen some family docs and some other people just like, you know, there's the blood test I send. You know, can you sort of explain maybe some of the differences between those?
Yeah, absolutely. So we could do either type of test, right? So the first test is a skin prick test. That's where you're in the office, you're doing a scratch on the back, and usually up until age 10 or 11 years old, I'm using the back rather than the arms, just because one, the upper back is a more sensitive area, and two, kids tend to reach and scratch places, and if it's right on the arm, they're going to probably mess up the test. That's something that parents are going to see immediate results, right? So I'm getting something back in 15 minutes. I'm coming back in, I'm reading those red bumps, and we have a positive and a negative control. So if the negative control is saline, you want that to be zero. If that's zero, anything that's three or above that control is going to be positive. Whereas if it's a 1x1 or a 2x2, I'm calling that negative. So that's kind of what skin testing looks like. The kids do okay with it. It's not painful. They just don't like to be poked or prodded by people that aren't their parents. And then the other set that you can do is a blood test. And so that's serum IgE testing. I'm much more willing to do some serum IgE testing potentially for environmental allergies rather than food allergies. And I can get more into that. But essentially, that's a blood draw. It takes more time to come back. So parents aren't going to get something right away that says yes or no. It's something that might take 3 or 4 days to come back. As far as sensitivity and specificity, they're very similar. So by doing the blood or the skin testing, I'm most likely going to get similar results, and false positives do occur. And they're more likely to occur, for example, in a kid with eczema where their total IgE levels are higher. And so in blood, you might get slightly higher false positives with those kiddos.
So you're telling us right now that you really need to be sensitized to because it sounds like these are mostly IgE mediated, if you guys can hear me appropriately. Yeah. And you have to be sensitized, so you're really not looking until 3 or 4 because you have to live in this world for enough time to get sensitization, unless it's like a dog is just laying on you for your entire life.
Which can happen. It does happen. I mean, there's a dog in this household, so if I ever have kids, they're going to be exposed early. But no, certainly for the seasonal ones.
Yeah. And then, you know, we were going to talk about treating seasonal allergies. So we're kind of let's pretend that Poppy's just a little bit older. But before we get into treatment, do you need to make a diagnosis with an allergy testing in order to say this person has seasonal allergies, or can you do it clinically?
Honestly, I feel that you can do it clinically, and I feel like most of my colleagues would agree. And sometimes I won't do the skin testing because it is invasive. Whether you're doing the skin prick testing or you're doing a blood test, you're doing something to the child. And if seasonal allergies are mild and they're well maintained on the medications we try, and I'm not moving towards allergy shots, sometimes we defer testing for the moment and kind of see how we do with just the medicines to start.
So you kind of mentioned that allergies pop up around 3 or 4. So at what age would you consider starting one of these treatments? And then what would that treatment, like what would the first line treatment look like? And maybe some of the common doses that you would use for different age groups?
Yeah. So some of the one, I think you can start treatment. I mean, I can start treatment after two for most things, right? And so you, even if it wasn't seasonal allergies, it's something else like persistent nasal congestion or something. I think some of our medications still work for that. And so first line would be intranasal steroids. And so you're looking at like fluticasone or mometasone or those types of medications. And usually in that age group, I'm starting with a pretty low dose of like one spray per nostril once daily, and really getting into with parents' technique, because most people, when they're squirting their nasal sprays, are spraying directly up towards that middle septum, causing irritation, nosebleeds, sores. People quit the medication because they're like, this isn't working and I'm getting all these issues. Instead, I spend a lot of time talking about the fact that we really need to learn that cross hand technique where our right hand's going to our left nostril, left hand's going to the right nostril, and we're squirting it out towards the side a little bit more so that we're avoiding those issues and we're also getting medication where it needs to go. The other medications I use in that younger age group too is intranasal antihistamines. So something like azelastine, you can do one spray per nostril twice daily as needed for the smaller kids. And then after 12 years of age, you can do it two sprays per nostril twice daily as needed. And honestly, I prefer both of those nasal sprays to just doing oral antihistamines like the second generation, cetirizine, fexofenadine, or loratadine. However, there are some parents where they are not going to do a nasal spray for their child, or their child is going to refuse, and I understand that. And so in that case, oral antihistamines can be a good place to start.
How about the intranasal medications? It would be reasonable to use more than one type. So could you possibly use an intranasal steroid as well as an intranasal antihistamine? And is there any utility in some of the more anticholinergic medications like intranasal ipratropium?
Yeah, so you can definitely use them together. And I tell patients all the time, you could actually do them back to back. It's not going to affect the medication. I use ipratropium, the one I'm thinking about is Atrovent, but I'll use that for older people typically, or like adults where they're having gustatory rhinitis, like especially with certain foods, spicy foods or things like that. Ipratropium can be really helpful and benefit that. Or if they're not getting away with just azelastine or fluticasone or the azelastine for whatever they can't tolerate, then I'll move to something like ipratropium and it wouldn't be wrong. It still does a good job of helping those symptoms.
And for our listeners, it sounds like there's kind of three intranasal pieces. Is one of them first line compared to the others?
So I think of the intranasal steroid as being the first line, but it really, it's so nuanced and individualized for the patient, because if I have someone who just has the seasonal allergy, say they act up in the spring and they're not someone who's willing to do something every day, I might say, let's go with that intranasal antihistamine, like the azelastine, because at least you're going to be doing something and you don't have to be consistent with it. Because fluticasone or the other intranasal steroids, you have to do this consistently. It's something where it takes time to build up. And once you stop it for a month, it's probably not going to do you any good just to do it as needed.
Gotcha. So it's a preventative medicine from that standpoint, really. I see.
Yeah, exactly. Almost like a maintenance, whereas like I think of azelastine as like almost like the rescue of like, use this, have another tool in your toolkit.
So what if we, for some of our patients with more than just sort of these rhinitis type symptoms, if they have the itchy eyes, maybe some other things going on, like can you still use the intranasal, and will my intranasal steroid still help some of my allergic conjunctivitis, or do I really need to sort of start thinking about more systemic type oral medications?
So actually doing the nasal sprays and being consistent can help with your eye symptoms. And the other thing I can recommend to families is doing olopatadine or another antihistamine eye drop rather than doing some oral medication. It's going to get right to the source. The tip I will give them is for the younger children, putting the drops in the fridge. It creates like a cooling, soothing effect, so it doesn't burn when you put it in the eye. And you can do one drop per eye per day. And that seems to work well too. I mean, oral antihistamines might help, but I think sometimes directly on the source is better.
So of the topical eye, with the topical, so the eye drops, you said olopatadine, which is once daily. I know they have, they also have the twice a day versions of that. And then I know there's some over the counter versions like ketotifen. Is that right?
Yes.
And when would the use be for each of those over the counter versus a prescription version?
Honestly, over the counter is fine. And I tell people, get what feels good. Some people do well with like the antihistamine based, whereas ketotifen is more the mast cell stabilizer based. And some people aren't getting enough relief with the antihistamine one, like olopatadine. So they add on ketotifen eye drops and kind of do one in the morning, one at night, or they mix and match. And you can do that. And it's totally okay.
Well, this is great. I'm over here frantically taking notes for the future. So this is excellent. So we were kind of saying this in the context of younger kids. The first line would be intranasal medications. Is that true for the older kids too? Or would Yes. there be a more important role for the oral antihistamines?
No, it's going to be first line is going to be those nasal sprays, whether you're a child, teen, or adult.
Okay.
It's just getting people to do them. It's the problem.
And so for the patients that say the families are resistant to doing the intranasal medications or they're just really wanting to do only an oral antihistamine, can you briefly go over kind of what the doses would look like for the different common ages?
Yeah. So for cetirizine, for example, I feel like that's a really easy medication and loratadine too, because it's just like one-to-one with your solution. And so for the younger kids, somebody that's like under age 2 or 3, I'll do 2.5 milligrams, which is 2.5 mLs for the liquid. And then once they get to preschool age, early school age, I'll do 5 milligrams. By the time they're reaching that like 12-year-old timeframe and getting into their teenage years, I'm doing 10 milligrams. Those are like the bare minimum of doses, because if you think about it for things like chronic hives, I could do up to 4 times that daily dose. So certainly if they needed it twice a day for whatever reason, it wouldn't be overdosing them with those medications.
And that was going to be actually, I was going to get a little bit of that side effect. So this is like a perfect piece, you know, because we talk about giving medicines to maybe intranasal corticosteroids to little babies or, you know, well, we haven't actually made that diagnosis, but you know, if we're like, screw it. And what is the downside to any of these medicines? It sounds like you can kind of go wild, go with lots of doses. It sounds like they're very safe. Is there anything we should be worried about?
There are very, very minimal side effects with that. I think the biggest thing with steroids, whether you're giving them topically for eczema or you're giving them intranasally for allergic rhinitis, or you're giving them inhaled for asthma, parents are very concerned because steroids have such a bad rap, especially in that oral version, which absolutely we should not be on chronic oral steroids. We want to avoid that. But as far as like affecting growth or affecting blood pressure levels or their sugar levels, it's not going to do any of that because of how localized it is. It's not going to deteriorate their nose tissue over time. I've heard lots of things, but really it's safe. Same thing with cetirizine or loratadine or fexofenadine. I actually prefer them much more over diphenhydramine, which I feel like a lot of people start with because it doesn't have the sedation side effects or the other things that make you worry, and it lasts for longer. So I actually think these are very safe medications to use in these younger kids.
And just as a pearl from that standpoint, what yeah. is the maximum dose? You know, we say, all right, so maybe an adult-sized person gets max of 10 milligrams of cetirizine loratadine. Yeah. Like, as an allergist, what's the real max dose?
So the depending on the condition, right? Well, my max dose for someone, if they're suffering with like chronic hives, I'll do 40 milligrams. So cool. 2 pills twice a day. For those older people, I have some of my younger kids. I have someone who has chronic hives who's 3, and I have him on probably 20 milligrams a day, and he's not that big, and he's doing fine with it. And so, yeah, you can definitely go up a little bit.
Do you ever hear about the paradoxical reactions for kids on diphenhydramine?
Yes. Yes, I have, because we're kind of switching over our how we feel about anaphylaxis, right, or our food allergy action plans. And we're trying to really get rid of diphenhydramine as the mild reaction treatment and instead replace it with cetirizine. And I always lead with, when we're having an anaphylactic reaction or we're having something else happen, sedation or lethargy can be part of that. And how do we know it wasn't the medicine? And the parent will be like, well, my kid gets hyper with it. So it's time, like, well, let's still use the cetirizine because it lasts for longer and it just makes me feel better, right? But certainly I know people, I don't have that reaction. I wish I did. When I take Benadryl or diphenhydramine, I'm out for the count.
Right.
But it can happen. So maybe don't try it right before you go on a plane with your kid, assuming it's going to put them to sleep because it may have the opposite effect.
So speaking of kind of adverse reactions, I learned a lot about montelukast and, you know, there's like the black box warning for it and everything. Is there actually a role for that in allergies?
In my expert opinion, I think honestly, if you look at the guidelines too, singular montelukast doesn't really have much of a role specifically in allergic rhinitis or even in asthma cases. It's really the inhaled steroids or the intranasal steroids. The only place that we really use it is more in an adult disease called ARD or aspirin respiratory exacerbated disease. And you do want people on montelukast or in that situation. But on kids, I rarely start it. And especially with that black box warning, it's like most of my kids have underlying ADHD or they have something else going on. And do I want to like even put that on the parents when there's other good medications to use?
We're going to start moving on from sort of the seasonal allergies. But before we do, I just want to say, are there any other possible treatments that you use in your personal practice that we haven't talked about?
Another big one is sinus rinses. I know people don't like to do them, but the Neelmed sinus rinse, especially if you're super congested or the kid is, sometimes the medication isn't going to get where it needs to go on those swollen tissues if you're really stopped up. So using those saline rinses can actually help wash things out. And then you apply your nasal steroid or your nasal antihistamine afterwards, and it can really help get it to where it needs to go. Sometimes, and I don't use it in kids as much, except for maybe older teens, I'll do budesonide saline rinses where they're essentially putting steroid into their saline rinse to get it where like further into the sinuses and where it needs to go rather than that. And then of course we have allergy shots and sublingual immunotherapy for those that are really suffering and need something. I try not to do that. And they're really, really young kids. Like I think the youngest I have on an allergy shot is probably 9. Wow. Because it's really time intensive. It's weekly shots and for a buildup period of 6 to 12 months. And then you're on it for 3 to 5 years monthly. So it is something to definitely think about before starting.
Gotcha.
And just for our listeners, I was just going to say, what are allergy shots? You know, my understanding is allergy shots are just a small dose of the allergen, and you're just essentially desensitization. Is that correct? Or is it a medicine that we should know about?
No, so it's exactly that. It's essentially using the extract. It's your own special formula. So that's a reason to do that skin testing, especially, but to get all those allergies. And then your doctor builds your formula. And then the reason you have to build up is you never want to just start out injecting the really strong allergen into your system that you're allergic to, because it can lead to severe reactions in the office. So instead, we start really, really tiny. And then we build up every single week until we're finally on that maintenance dose, which is still a small dose, but it's very effective.
And so how exactly does that happen? Can you explain exactly how quote unquote desensitization happens, or are we actually making some sort of change in the body and how it reacts to the antigen, and how long does it last, and do allergy shots go on for the rest of your life, or can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So you are essentially changing your immune response to that allergen by slowly introducing it. Over time, your body becomes more and more tolerant. You start making less and less IgE to it and more of those tolerance antibodies. So you are essentially losing your sensitization to the allergen. Before, probably like in the last couple of decades, people were on shots forever. But now we really know that that immune system change happens in the first couple years of maintenance. And we typically only need to keep people on them for 3 to 5 years. There are some people that come off their shots and say, oh, immediately my sinus headaches returned or that, and they'll stay on them for longer. But really that change can be very long lasting. I think the earlier you do the shots, and this may be anecdotal, I think the earlier you do the shots and you change your immune system, but then you get done with shots at 9, for example, but then you start getting more and more allergies as you get older. So sometimes it changes. Or the fact that as you get older, non-allergic rhinitis comes more into play. So that's things where you have irritants, like smoke exposure, changes in weather, strong odors and fragrances. And so people are mistaking that for return of their seasonal allergies. And it's really, they're just developing these non-allergy irritants to their nose that produce similar symptoms.
Awesome. I mean, I think we covered the gamut for seasonal allergies and this combined. And I was thinking we'd move on to food allergies, but does anyone have any last questions?
I do want to make one thing clear. When we tell people to use those saline rinses, make sure they're using not tap water. We don't need
maybe.
Yeah, no amoebas in people's brains, please.
Yes, please boil the water for 5 minutes and let it cool off, or use your distilled water bottles. I like it. I like that plug.
Awesome. There we go. All right, Olivia, you mind moving on and reading the next part of the case?
Yes, let's get to the next one. So poor Poppy Pollen cannot catch a break, and now family is calling us, and she has developed a full body rash several minutes after trying eggs for the first time. So this is another common thing I see in clinic all the time, and kids seem to get a bunch of different rashes when they're trying new foods. So it can be just around their mouth, full body rashes, hives. So what are the different types of reactions that we may be seeing in this case, and when should we worry?
Yeah. So I think that's a great question, because introducing food for parents seems to be a very scary thing. I think it's become very medicalized in the last little bit, especially with the LEAP study coming out and people really harping on that early introduction of peanut, which we do want, but then I think it scares families a little bit. And so the different reactions I think about happening, and specifically in this case, when something is a full body rash or it is hives that is occurring in more than just the area that the food contacted, that's when I might be concerned for the development of an IgE-mediated allergy, something that might produce hives, swelling, difficulty breathing, or vomiting, and that person certainly needs to be referred and evaluated further for that allergy. When I think about kids who get just the rash around their mouth where the food contacts, we really think of that as perioral dermatitis or contact irritant, a rash that can happen for kids with eczema, but it can also happen with any kid. It's very likely with like acidic foods like tomato, like you'll hear it with like pasta sauce a lot, but it can honestly happen with any food, including egg, peanut, all of those things. And for those kids where the splotchy rash or things did not continue onto any other area of the body, there was no other red flag symptoms, I'm going to tell them to reintroduce that at home. I'm going to say this is likely contact irritant rash, and then we're going to talk about a plan as far as what can we do to help reduce those symptoms. For example, I'll tell people to use Aquaphor ointment, Vaseline, some other barrier where they're going to put it around each time that the kid is eating, because that's going to keep the food from touching the face, hopefully. Some kids are messy, so you can put it on their chest too, whatever they're doing to eat. And then I'll tell them as soon as they are done eating, rinse them off. So you just don't want that food sitting there for a prolonged period of time to cause more irritation. And usually that helps a lot. And then it tends to get better as they are less messy with their eating as well. And so most cases of those, they can keep reintroducing without any issues. And then there's the kids where they have eczema and maybe they have dairy. I'm just making up foods, right? Dairy or wheat. And then 2 days later, their eczema is worse. Or even a day later, their eczema is worse. I'm going to really encourage the family to keep that food in the diet, because food allergies don't cause eczema. Eczema anecdotally can certainly, certain foods can worsen eczema, but it's not a food allergy. And they should keep it in the diet and treat the eczema. The only exception I made for that is someone who their eczema was bright red flaring minutes after eating the food. And that had me concerned that something else was going on there.
So that kind of leads me to my next question. So in this case, it was several minutes after trying eggs. So yeah. Is there a time course where you would be more or less worried from exposure to full body rash?
Yeah, exactly. So within 1 to 2 hours, I'm going to think this might be related and this might be an immediate reaction to the food. Most kids who are allergic to a food you're going to see something with that in that first 30 minutes. It usually doesn't hide itself. And once something's 6 hours later, 8 hours later, I am not going to immediately assume it's due to the food, because we really don't have food allergies that cause that, except for alpha-gal syndrome, which is the tick bite one with mammalian meat, which is not it's really only in the Southeast. And it's more adults than kids.
So I have actually more of a differential diagnosis quick, because I like kind of seeing things black and white a little bit. Yeah. And So are there any disease processes from an allergy perspective that if you took in a food and then subsequently had a full body rash, is there something that is not IgE mediated that we should think about? Because then it makes my life pretty easy.
Not really. When I see a full body rash that's red and itchy right after eating a food, I'm thinking it's probably an IgE-mediated process, and I can't really think of what else I might think it is other than it was coincidental, like they have a virus or they have something else going on, and then that lasts for days. For example, I had a kid who came in worried about strawberry allergy. They had developed hives maybe 10, 15 minutes after eating 10 or 12 strawberries, but they eat strawberries every single night. They're like 7 years old. And then ultimately, those hives stayed around for 5 days. Then I was like, I'm going to test you, but I really think it was unrelated to food. The strawberry test was negative. They since reintroduced strawberry without any problem. And so in that case, sometimes that time course of like how long it took to go away can be a clue as to was this really the food or not. But when you have an infant, first time exposed, second time exposed, third time exposure, and immediately they're flaring up with a huge splotchy rash, that's a little bit more worrisome.
Yeah, and it makes it easier for us. If we get that phone call, we're like, all right, it doesn't sound like there's nothing else that this could be. So we are going to tell you not to eat that again and go see the allergist.
Yes.
So, I mean, one common thing I get in the office a lot is, you know, a kid, you know, has been eating some, you know, fruit. So mom's like, dad's like, every time they eat this fruit, you know, they get this tingly sensation in the back of the throat, a little itchy, scratchy, but nothing else. Like, is this a completely different type of thing that we have to worry about? And do we manage it differently?
Yeah. So potentially when I see kids, and it tends to be older kids, and I don't know how old this kid was in your office, but it tends to be the older kids and teens where they start to have issues with fruits, where they're getting fresh fruits, where they're getting mouth itching or throat itching. They might even sometimes get bumps around the mouth where they weren't doing that before with the fruit. And it can be something called oral allergy syndrome or pollen food allergy syndrome, where essentially they have seasonal or environmental allergies where the proteins in that pollen are so similar to the proteins that are in the fruit that it can produce symptoms for them when they're eating the fruit. Typically, it's only the mouth and the throat or in those oropharyngeal symptoms because the proteins are heat labile. I mean, as soon as they're digested, as soon as they're taken, they're broken down really quickly, unlike our typical food allergies, which are heat stable proteins. So in those cases, they can eat the food cooked. So usually they have no problems with like jams or preservatives or like things where it's baked in a dessert or whatever it may be. But I will tell them to avoid if it causes discomfort. There's a very, very, very tiny risk of it becoming a severe allergic reaction, like less than 1 to 2%. And that's usually if it's to nuts and not to the fresh fruits and fresh vegetables. So they typically don't need an EpiPen. They can just avoid. The only thing to really treat it is some people want to use their cetirizine or their other things and just let it itch. But really the only thing that could potentially treat it is allergy shots. And some people want to go through that because they're allergic, like they're having oral allergy syndrome, like 20 fruits or vegetables. And some people are like, yeah, it's one thing. I'm not that worried about it. I don't want shots for 5 years. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds reasonable.
So getting back to Poppy pollen a little bit. So now it sounds like she has a rash immediately after eggs. We're thinking that this is a true allergy. So when would it be safe for her to be exposed to this again? And then how do you counsel families? Now they might be more nervous about trying new foods. How would you counsel them? And it might be a good time to touch on like definition of anaphylaxis and how you explain that to parents.
Yeah. So I probably would not be reintroducing that food at home. I would be coming to the allergist office where we would do a combination of skin and blood testing potentially and figuring out where our numbers are, because based on that, we may not give egg again, and it's like scrambled egg form, but we may decide that they can tolerate baked egg because almost 80% of people who are egg allergic can actually tolerate baked egg, which opens up the diet a lot. But that could be something we would do it at the allergist office in a challenge setting where they're not at home and we can actually monitor them safely and make sure that they're doing well. When I talk about counseling, because a lot of times I get kids seen from like they went to the ED for their first reaction, or they saw an outside PC, like their outside pediatrician, and they had a reaction at 6 months old, and they were told don't introduce any new solids until you see the allergist. And now they're 11 months old seeing me, and they truly have not introduced anything else. And once you have one food allergy or you have eczema, you're at increased risk for more food allergy. And so it's really important that they still introduce foods. And so I talk through parents with a plan. I'm like, here are major allergens, our top 9, and I want you to slowly introduce one at a time, obviously avoiding the one that your child reacted to. I tell them to take a small pea-sized amount, feed it to them, wait 10, 15 minutes. If there's no concerning symptoms like a splotchy rash or like a hive or anything like that, they're going to keep feeding that food and they're just going to increase the amount they give over 3 to 4 days. Once they're at like a normal serving size for that age, then at that point, I'm going to say, please, please keep this food in the diet 1 to 2 times a week. It is really important that you not only introduce early, but that you keep it regularly in the diet so that your body keeps saying, hey, I tolerate this. I want to keep eating it. This is great. I'm not allergic. If your parent is like, we are not going to introduce anything else until we see the allergist, put in an urgent referral for allergy, because I will have that conversation, or whoever their allergist is will have that conversation and hopefully get them on a good path to keep introducing the foods. But I just hate when people are like told, oh, you have a peanut allergy, so avoid all tree nuts, when really there's only a 30% cross-reactivity. Peanuts are legumes and tree nuts are the nuts. And so you don't necessarily need to avoid those.
You know, I think you just hit on amazing pearls and that we can absolutely use in the primary care office just to kind of help us close this loop.
Yes.
what are, you kind of mentioned, what are the 9 kind of most common allergies? And then what are any links that we should know about or very much not know about?
So there's cow's milk, egg, wheat, soy, sesame, peanut, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish. There is some cross reactivity between peanut and tree nuts, like I said, about 30%, but the majority of people who are peanut allergic can tolerate tree nuts. The majority of people that are tree nut allergic can tolerate peanuts. And then even within the tree nuts. So there are lots of people that are only allergic to cashew pistachio. Cashew pistachio, you should probably know that relationship. They're highly cross-reactive. So if you had a patient who came in and said, we had cashew anaphylaxis, you're probably going to tell them, please avoid pistachio, at least till you see the allergist. Similar with walnut pecan, they're not as cross-reactive as cashew pistachio, but they're almost like cousins. And so there are some people where they're going to be allergic to both. And you could probably say, oh, maybe avoid this one unless you're already regularly eating it in the diet until you see the allergist. There is no significant cross-reactivity that I think about between fish and shellfish. And then even within shellfish, there's bivalves, and then there's your regular crustaceans like the shrimp, crab, lobster versus scallops, oyster, and clams. And so there are some people who can tolerate the bivalves and not tolerate the others, but we figure that out in the allergy office.
Yeah, so as you're trying to figure this in the allergy office, that's, you're probably doing these the skin testing for that, is that right? And so do you have like little, like you have these big things like little pieces of shrimp, little pieces of mussel that you have these antigens are like, do you have a big fridge with like a smorgasbord of food? And what if like, do you ever have parents bring in a special food that they had so they can be like, you know, this is our ethnic food that we bring in from who knows where. And like, you're not going to have that in your library of stuff in your refrigerator. I don't know.
Yeah. No, that's actually a great question. So we have these skin testing trays, and they're essentially extracts that are made by allergen companies that have the proteins in it, but they're not like they're just like the real food. We have a limited number, right? So I think we maybe have like 35 or 40 we can test from. And so if there's something that's not on the skin testing tray that the kid has potentially reacted to, the parent will bring in that item, and then we prick the item, and then we prick the skin, and we call it a fresh prick to prick. And so we can certainly do that. Sometimes it's impossible because people are coming in and they're like, I reacted to Takis chips, or I reacted to Chinese food or something like that. And in some cases, I've done Takis chip challenges. I've done Chinese food challenges because the history was not as concerning. And so I was like, let's just come in and you eat the food and just bring your Chinese food, bring your Takis, and we'll do it. And they've passed. So I think it's just was unrelated, right? And then I think that brings us to the next point is that when I am seeing a kid for the first time in my allergy clinic for skin testing or blood testing or concern for that food allergy reaction, I am not testing all the foods. I am not testing every major allergen, especially if they haven't tried it and there's no history of a reaction, because we have a very low positive predictive value of our test. I'll quote it as like a 50% false positive rate. And so we're really, when we get these food allergy panels, and I get them a lot from outside pediatricians or outside primary care doctors where the concern was like diarrhea or something or constipation, and we're getting a food allergy panel, things are coming back positive, and really the kid was tolerating the food, but we're overdiagnosing allergy, and then we're potentially eliminating things from the diet we don't need to. So I'm very specific with parents, and I really try to get away from testing a bunch of different things. If I have to, because the parent is too anxious to introduce, I will, but I feel like I'm able to interpret those. We make the deal if a test is positive, they're willing to challenge it if they never eat the food. And most parents follow that advice.
I was going to make a joke. I was just going to say, like, I was trying to imagine your waiting room smell like Takis and chow mein or something like that every single day.
I mean, I wish they would bring some to share. That'd be great. Not the Takis, though. Those kill your stomach, people. Don't eat them.
So you mentioned a little bit, some kids are coming in with like a serum allergy panel. Is there a role in the outpatient setting or otherwise to ever be sending a serum panel for allergies?
No, it is. It's actually recommended against not only by the American Academy of Pediatrics, but also our allergy organizations. And so I wish they would stop. We took it out of OHSU's library of tests. You can't even order it at OHSU anymore. And I wish that other people like practices would do that as well. But really you're doing a disservice to the patient. There's a cost there, a cost burden, because if you're telling them to eliminate things, then they're coming to an allergist. I'm telling them to put back things. We might have challenges. We might have all these things. And now we've disrupted a diet of a child that's already picky. And so I really just don't feel like there's a role for full allergy panel testing. If someone was in a really remote location and they wanted to test to the one food the kid reacted to because they weren't going to get in the allergist for a while and parents were curious, I think that's reasonable, but there's no reason to order a bunch of them.
And is the sensitivity with the IgE, you know, any of the IgE blood tests, is that sensitivity and specificity different than the allergy prick test?
It's very similar, actually. They both can produce, it's a very low positive predictive value. I mean, it's great if it's all negative, right? Because it's like the negative predictive value is really high. It's like a 98, 99% chance you're not allergic to that thing. But more often than not, I get these really low positives of things where now the parent's like, but they were eating this and now I feel like they can't because they're allergic. I'm like, no, they're not allergic. They're sensitized. They're not clinically allergic. And then I have to go back in time and try to undo what's been done.
So this way, actually, Olivia, do you have a question? Because I have something that's completely non-segued. So,
Oh, I was just going to say, so we kind of talked about, it seems like if there's concern for an allergy, the next step is really sending the kids to you and not bothering doing a serum panel on our own. And so I was just going to kind of touch on or ask you, like, when are the other indications for a referral for you? I get a lot of, you know, I'm worried about a bee sting. I have never been stung by a bee. Is that an appropriate referral? When should we refer kids to you?
Yeah. So I think for honestly, you can refer anytime. It's not a bad thing to refer. We're happy to talk to them. Certainly with the food allergies, where there's concern or there's like progressing asthma or something like that, see them. For the bee sting one, that's a great question, because I actually get a lot of those that came in with like local reactions. So are like large local reactions and they want testing. And so I have to go through the whole thing of why we don't test for certain reactions. And so if they've never been stung, there is no point in doing that. There are so many false positives without testing. And then it's, what is the result of testing? The reason we test is to potentially put somebody on venom immunotherapy or venom shots to help prevent anaphylaxis in the future. So even with large local reactions and systemic reactions, meaning the kid had full body hives, I am not going to recommend testing. I'm not going to recommend venom immunotherapy. And certainly if they would like an EpiPen, I mean, maybe we should all have one, right? It's not a bad thing to keep around. But they don't need that extra step because their chance of anaphylaxis on a subsequent exposure is still less than 1% to 2% like the general population. When someone's had lightheadedness, breathing trouble, a true anaphylactic reaction to a bee sting, that's different. That requires testing. We really encourage venom shots because the chance of you having anaphylaxis again is 40 to 70%. That's a huge jump. And then when you do venom immunotherapy, that takes it down to like 5% on subsequent exposure. So I try to encourage people, and you can tell them it hurts to get tested for bee stings. It's not just skin prick testing, it's intradermal testing. So they're sticking a needle under your skin multiple times to do this and on a child, that's awful. And so usually parents are like, oh, okay, like we're good. Like we won't do that now.
So I want to kind of bring it back to Poppy a little bit. We kind of learned a little bit about why we should send to allergy. And so I was thinking, hey, when we get that call or she comes into our clinic, you know she saw eggs. We got your awesome advice that we're actually going to can restart something like peanuts, which we heard to restart early. You might talk about the LEAP trial in a second. But say we start it, you know, a small little bit, you know, like watch them for 10 minutes. I imagine we are also going to give them an EpiPen because as they watch them, we should probably say, hey, if something like this happens, you should probably use that and do something about it. I was wondering if you could kind of walk us through, like, as you're giving them a small little bit and you're going up over a couple of days, what is that going to look like?
Yeah, absolutely. They should definitely be getting the EpiPen because they had the food allergy, right? So they had something where they had a full body rash right after eating a food. We want to make sure that we're counseling them on the EpiPen and when to use it. And so I always go over that in my own clinic of, okay, say we ate the food. And for example, if we're trying peanut, now we're on our third day of peanut and we get, let's say, some hives on the face or maybe like hives on the chest where the food didn't touch, but kid's breathing okay, we're not vomiting, we're feeling overall good, we're not super irritable. That's a time where you can use like one of the second generation oral antihistamines. So something like cetirizine or fexofenadine, you can give that to the child, wait 15, 20 minutes and just kind of see what happens and make sure things are resolving. Sometimes if they're completely unbothered and not itching or fussy or anything like that, some people you can just let them self-resolve too. Most likely nothing else is happening, especially when you're doing such small amounts in babies, less than 1 year old. It's a lot less of a risk to have anaphylaxis on those smaller exposures. If for whatever reason, your kid has full body hives with swelling places, or has vomiting repetitively, or is coughing, or there's breathing trouble or something, that is going to be automatically the EpiPen. Please do not wait and give the second generation oral antihistamine first. The treatment is going to be the EpiPen. And so then I walk them through how to use the EpiPen. And that might include a special like football hold, because kids are a little bit different than adults. We have to hold them down to give that shot. And then I talk them through each of the different EpiPens that they might get. And I have a trainer in clinic that I show them. So hopefully you guys have something similar where you could potentially show them in clinic how to use the EpiPen. I always give the advice too that the pharmacy can pull the trainer out of the box at the pharmacy and show them how to use it. So there should never be a reason why they didn't get their specific EpiPen shown to them.
Is EpiPen a brand name? Do we have other brands? Do we use it just as, I mean, I feel we use it a lot. Is it as universal as saying Kleenex and stuff like that, just to be clear?
I feel like it is, but you could say epinephrine auto injector if you want to be generic about it. There are different brands. There's like the epinephrine generic. There's the EpiPen, EpiPen Junior. There's AviQ, Syngepi. There's some other ones too. But I feel like when you say EpiPen in general, the parents know what you're talking about, but you can get different ones.
And do you normally give, how many do you prescribe at a time? Like, especially for our school age children, do you give one for school? Do you, I know some parents who try to keep in the glove compartment, but like, does the heat, like, will that destroy it? Like, how do you give some advice on EpiPens? I'm sorry, epinephrine auto injectors.
You already went for it.
The epinephrine auto injectors, yes. So I will usually prescribe them to each so that they can have a twin pack at home and a twin pack at school. Sometimes they want an extra twin pack because they go to grandma's, grandma needs a twin pack, whatever. So I'll make sure that they have enough. I always tell them that the twins are besties. They like to be together. They don't want to be separated, because in the off chance you have a very severe reaction, you can give a second dose of epinephrine if it's needed. And so you want to make sure that you have that option and that those two stay together. And so I will let them know that. I tell them to please not leave it in the car, because you are absolutely correct in the fact that heat exposure or other things can denature that product and make it less effective. So I'll usually talk with them about carrying in the diaper bag or carrying in a school bag. If they're going to the beach or they're going to the pool, I'll tell them to bring like an insulated like lunchbox and they can keep it in there. There are some available on Amazon that are specifically for epinephrine. For my older kids, the teenagers, I tell them to keep it in their gym bag, to keep it in their book bag, to keep it in their purses. Some of the boys, they're a little bit harder to get carry because most of our girls like to carry bags and other things, but sometimes that's when I can get the AviQ approved for them because it's square, rectangle, and it easily fits in the back of a pocket. But it should be on them. And I asked that question in clinic. I'm like, do you carry your EpiPen or epinephrine auto injector all the time? And they're like, yes. I said, okay, well, where is it? Oh, well, it's in my book bag in the car. I said, then you don't carry it all the time. We got to change that.
Nice. I have, you know, just as that final piece that we were talking about, Poppy, how we got to the epinephrine auto injector question. If you do use the cetirizine, they do fine. Can you keep going? Or do we call this somewhere in the middle? Like, what do you tell the family?
Yeah, if it's something where they're developing hives or something else pretty quickly after eating it on the third exposure, I'm going to tell them to hold off and come see me in clinic. Cool. We'll do the testing. We'll talk about potentially introducing small amounts and keeping going versus stopping. Perfect. And waiting another year. Yeah.
Perfect. That's where we're going to call the line, primary care. You know, but that's pretty, we got pretty far.
So all of this, like, the goal is to avoid these scary reactions. And so I know I have heard through the grapevine over the years that there is benefit in early introduction of these, you know, more allergy prone foods. Can you talk a little bit more about maybe briefly covering on that study and like how you counsel families on this as well?
Yeah, so the LEAP study, the data came out in 2015, but essentially it was looking at people that weren't sensitized yet, some that were already sensitized, and then they had, so on their testing, they did skin prick testing or blood testing showing either they were negative or positive, and then they had people avoid for up to 5 years of, or to include it for 5 years. So they had some people avoid it. And for those that were avoiding and sensitized or not sensitized, the levels of peanut allergy were much, much higher, like 30-something% compared to like I would have to look at the exact numbers on the study, but it was like compared to like maybe like 8%, like more regular peanut allergy numbers, showing that early introduction really did help, even in people who were already sensitized but could tolerate. So the longer they went without eating it, the more likely they were to develop that peanut allergy. And similar things have been shown with like the Australian Eat study, that early introduction of different foods can be helpful, although it wasn't as strong as the LEAP study data. And that's why those guidelines for the AAP or the American Academy of Pediatrics changed in 2017 to include early introduction. I think there was still a lot of, it's a little nebulous or a little hand wavy, like when it wasn't coming to people with eczema. So severe eczema was like pretty clear, go to your allergist, get peanut screening. Well, now we're even saying, is that necessary? Are we over-diagnosing allergy by bringing all these severe kids with eczema? Because we know that they're more likely to have positive results. And then it was like mild to moderate, introduce at 6 months or so. And then I had debates with my attendings because I was like, oh yeah, everyone can introduce early. And they're like, wait, they didn't say that. They only said kids with eczema. I was like, we can extrapolate. Like if kids with eczema can do it, everyone can do it. But the kids without eczema, I don't think it's as urgent necessarily as the kids that do are higher risk with eczema or already have a food allergy.
So that actually takes me to my next question as well, is we want to make sure we're giving equal care to everybody. Yeah. And so I have seen that children of minority groups and lower socioeconomic status are being disproportionately affected by food allergies. Can you speak more on that and like how we can counsel patients differently in the outpatient setting?
Yeah, I think it's a huge part of it is cost burden. And it comes from not only the diagnosis and recognizing of allergy and thinking about prevention as far as early introduction. It's important to counsel every patient the same, but we have to remember that especially with food insecurity or they're using potentially WIC or something else to provide those foods, allergen-free foods are like allergen foods are very expensive. Getting cashew butter is ridiculous. It's like $12 a pop at the store. And so being able to work with them and potentially give a prescription saying, hey, we need these foods from WIC or like helping them out with that or potentially having like a food bank in your clinic or something where you can give out samples. But knowing that that's why they're potentially going to be, from the prevention standpoint, already disadvantaged compared to someone who can afford these foods. And then the next part of it is management, like how much regular follow-up are they having with either the allergist or you? Because a lot of these kids are going to the ED, which is another cost burden. A lot of them can't afford EpiPens or epinephrine auto-injectors. Even with Medicaid, the copay, like I think they're pretty covered, but other insurances aren't. And just because you don't have Medicaid doesn't mean that you're not still in that lower socioeconomic status. And so are there ways that we can make sure that they're getting appropriate epinephrine auto-injectors so they're not going to ED every single time they have a reaction? And then for me, I try to follow up really closely, like as much as I can, especially for the younger kids. I'll see them every couple of months while they're introducing foods so that I make sure that parents are feeling supported and that they're getting the equal care. And then the other piece of it is treatment, right? So the treatment options we have for food allergy, none of them are cures, but thinking about like oral immunotherapy or sublingual immunotherapy or even omalizumab, which was recently approved in February, those are all expensive things. So they are not going to have equal access to food allergy treatments, especially in the private practice setting, as a kid who comes from a family that's the higher socioeconomic status. And so here at OHSU, we're trying to cover all the cost and get everything under their insurance so that everyone can have the equal opportunity to do oral immunotherapy or even to do omalizumab at clinic.
You bring up a couple of questions I have, and I'm trying to parse how I'm going to when I should ask each one. But first, I'm going to start with, when you're talking about food insecurities and trying to help with trying to get certain foods. Now, I guess this also may also apply to all the other parents who might be asking some questions. Like, will they ever outgrow some of these food allergies? Is this something they'll always have to worry about? Is the first question I'm going to ask.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. For allergies such as cow's milk, egg, wheat, soy, those are actually outgrown by a majority of people, typically by school age, but now we know it can sometimes take longer until around age 16. But most of my kids are going to outgrow that. Tree nuts, peanuts, shellfish, fish, seeds tend to be more lifelong, although there was a recent study showing that about 1 in 3 people before age 5 do outgrow their peanut allergies, so there's a chance for it, which is why those early appointments with allergists and repeating testing and potentially getting a window where you can challenge the food in clinic can be really important. But you can outgrow some allergies. Some are going to be there for you for life. Typically, you don't develop them as much as an adult, but you still can. So it can have, it's mostly in this younger group, but you can develop them when you're older too.
And I guess my next question is, you sort of brought up some other treatment options that we didn't really talk about earlier. Can you explain a little more about what sublingual therapy means, and then the MAB therapy? I'm not even going to try to say it.
No, that's okay. Yeah. So we think of, like, I think everyone knows or has heard of OIT, or oral immunotherapy. That's where you're giving a small amount of the food every single day, and you're building them up every 2 weeks in the office until they get to what we call this maintenance dose, for the pure point of doing bite-proof protection. So our real goal is minimizing their risk if they have an accidental exposure. It's not necessarily curing the allergy. The same is true of sublingual immunotherapy, which is where you do drops under the tongue. People like sublingual immunotherapy because it's much lower dose. So for example, for peanut, I'll just use that because that's like our quintessential food allergy. For oral immunotherapy, the maintenance dose might be 300 milligrams, but for sublingual, it's 4 milligrams. So there's much less adverse risk. There's not as many rules or guidelines around taking it. And it's safer for those older kids too. So people like it. Again, it's just providing bite-proof protection. It's not going to cure your food allergy. Omalizumab is just Xolair, or the anti-IgE monoclonal antibody. It's been used for years in chronic hives and asthma, but it was recently approved for food allergy in ages 1 and up. Essentially, it's the same thing. You're getting injections, though, every 2 to 4 weeks, depending on your total IgE and your weight. And then the goal, again, is you're reducing that, you're increasing your threshold for a reaction. So if you were accidentally exposed, you would be protected against having potentially an anaphylactic episode. Again, these are like long-term, lifelong therapies, because once you stop them, you're slowly going to lose that protection over time. The pro of omalizumab is that it's multiple food allergies at once, although some people do multi-food OIT and multi-food slit. But the con is it's really expensive. Insurance companies fight you on it and don't want to really approve it. And again, it's an injection for a young kid potentially.
And just to wrap up that thought, yep. Comparing it to the actual allergen shots themselves, is it just same concept, different exposure, or is one considered a cure and one's not considered a cure?
So for the allergy shots for environmental, we don't have them for food.
We don't have them for food. Gotcha. That's a big difference. Okay.
That's a big difference. When they originally tried, I think it was like 30, 40 years ago, in studies to do more of that subcutaneous immunotherapy with like allergy shots for food, and people were having anaphylactic reactions. They had to stop the study. Gotcha. Just because it was much more common than with the environmental allergies. But omalizumab is kind of that.
Yeah.
It's the injection medicine, but it's really working for everything. And it's really, the idea is you're stabilizing your mast cell or your allergy cell, because you're reducing the number of receptors on that cell, and you're eating up the free IgE in the body.
Cool. Chris, did you have any, I know you had a list of questions to follow up that last piece. Do you have any more, or should we move on to the next case?
She hit them all really good. Olivia, maybe we can go on to the next case. You named this little boy very
well. Yeah, Olivia, you're going to have to say it.
You're going to have to say it.
I was going to say, you guys may be shocked to know that this is a made-up name, but here we go. So your next patient is a four-year-old. There's so much buildup. Okay. Your next patient is a four-year-old boy, Mac, ulopapular rash, who presented with a full body rash on day 4 of 7 of amoxicillin that he was on for a previously diagnosed ear infection. He is otherwise normal health, unbothered. So what is going on? Is this a true allergy?
This is such a common case that I get. And I will also still have my friends who are pediatricians back in North Carolina text me about this. But we think of this when I see somebody that's having a maculopapular rash, so not hives, first of all, although sometimes that can happen, but it's happening 4 days into the course of the antibiotic. There's two things I think of, and it's hard to tell, you know, which one's actually happening. Is it a delayed, like a type 4 delayed hypersensitivity that's like more T-cell mediated to the actual antibiotic? Or is, why are we on the amoxicillin? We have an ear infection. Did that start with a virus? And is this a viral exanthem that maybe was exacerbated by the fact we're on an antibiotic? So it's like, who knows which one that could be? But the reassuring part of this is that it did not happen on that first or second dose. It did not happen immediately after ingesting the antibiotic. It was not hives or difficulty breathing or something that was happening immediately afterwards. So just right off the bat, I'm not worried about an IgE-mediated allergy.
Wait. What if mom or dad said, I have an amoxicillin allergy, so this must be it, right?
Yeah. So I let parents know that you don't pass on specific allergies. I say that if you have an allergy, like say you have seasonal allergies, your kid is more likely to have eczema, asthma, seasonal allergies, food allergy, drug, whatever. But it's not a one-to-one, like our whole family has penicillin allergy, and I would love to test the parent too, because I bet they don't either. And we need to label everybody that we can. But in this case, I am reassured by that story. And so I would not necessarily call this an IgE-mediated allergy to, in fact, I would not call it an IgE-mediated allergy to amoxicillin. And this is something that very likely this kid, you could give it to them again in the future, and they may or may not have any similar symptoms to this at all. And it's not something where you necessarily have to label them as penicillin allergic.
So we've been, we teased in the beginning a little bit talking about some of these mechanisms of actions when it comes to drug allergy. So here we are right back at it. You know, so when we think of IgE mediated reaction, we're thinking of a IgE antibody going to a mast cell in some way, shape or form, which you could probably explain to us better, but then, causing degranulation of release and histamine release and boom, causing lots of swelling.
Yeah.
How is the type 4? This is a T cell response. Like, what happens there and why should we not be nearly as concerned about compared to the IgE based?
Yeah. And you could potentially have to still be concerned about the T cell mediated. I'll get into that and explain that a little bit. But specifically, you're thinking this is more of like a delayed, almost like allergic contact dermatitis. So you're seeing that it's got to sit in there or be in that. And then slowly your T cells are kind of destroying things and causing symptoms. So it's not something where it's immediate. It's not causing anaphylaxis. It's not going to affect our breathing. But you can still get a nasty little rash with it. And I think the most like the one everyone thinks about is allergic contact dermatitis with nickel. But we also know that those are our type 4 reactions, just like you said, and you can have ones that are scary and ones that we need to have red flag symptoms for and ones that we need to be worried about. And that's your scars or your severe cutaneous adverse reactions. Those are actually in that type 4 category. Those are things like Stevens-Johnson syndrome or DRESS, where if we're seeing fever or joint pain or sloughing of the skin or other organ dysfunction, that's going to be a red flag stop for me. And we're going to say, yeah, we're probably not having this drug again. But this case does not have any of those red flag symptoms, which is also reassuring. I can go through the other two types a little bit, but type 2 is more of a cytotoxic reaction. And then type 3 is our serum sickness. And we get a lot of serum sickness-like reactions too with penicillin antibiotics. And like, do we ever use it? Because like, before, if it was type 3, type 4 with like a scar or a severe adverse, you were not giving that antibiotic again. But now we're saying with serum sickness-like reaction, we can actually try to give that antibiotic again, and it would likely be okay.
That was kind of going to be our next question is, can we continue the amoxicillin? So it sounds like for type 1 IgE-mediated, no.
No. Yeah.
If we learned anything over the last hour, it's hopefully maybe not right now.
Peter,
sorry, keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, no. And for type 3, a serum sickness, like in the moment, you're probably stopping it because you have to treat with steroids and make them feel better. But in the future, I would probably not hesitate to potentially do that antibiotic again if it was needed. And for type 4, if it's truly just the maculopapular rash, you're not having fever, organ dysfunction, weird blistering in the skin, anything that's concerning you, you could potentially, especially in a kid who's unbothered, continue the course. You could give a second generation antihistamine if they were bothered. And we do that with some of our adults to get them through their courses of antibiotics. Or you could say, whatever, we'll switch it to something else. But I wouldn't hesitate in the future to try it again. Because most of the time, that reaction may not occur.
So with any parents who are worried about saying, you really sure you want me to my kid to try it again? How do you reassure them? And how maybe how might there be ways that a general pediatrician's office might be able to retry this in a safe way?
Yeah. So I will usually talk about the difference between like why I was reassured in the first place and the difference between an anaphylactic type reaction or what I'm worried about with an immediate reaction versus what's going on for them. But sometimes I do a little clinical challenge and I just challenge them to amoxicillin in the office. Sometimes that's not going to be possible potentially in your pediatrics offices, but sometimes maybe there is the staffing or the room to do that. And you can give a dose of amoxicillin in clinic, observe them for an hour and send them on their way and just reassure them that they're not having an IgE or an immediate type reaction.
And so just to clarify, so say a kid comes in and they're not having the severe type 4 skin sloughing, mucosal involvement rash from amoxicillin. Are we automatically reassured because it is not after the first or second dose? Or is there anything else in that context that I should be looking out for in my office?
No, I'm typically very reassured when it's not an immediate reaction and you're not seeing any of those red flag symptoms that, especially with just a maculopapular rash, I would be like, okay to keep going or to try again in the future.
So my next question is, so say we decide that maybe this patient has a true IgE-mediated allergy to amoxicillin. The next question is, during the next infection, what medications can I use? Can I still use a beta-lactam? I still have some PTSD from med school. I remember learning all sorts of these ring structures for beta-lactam. The cephalosporin was sort of like a hexagon, and these other beta-lactams were a pentagon, and it was like the house with the driveway. I don't know if anyone else learned these ring structures. No, am I just weird? Okay. And so is it true that we have all this cross-reactivity to these ring structures, or is there a different thing going on? And how do we decide what medications we can use?
Yeah. So we actually think about it as being the R1 side chain rather than the beta-lactam ring that there's cross-reactivity with. And still, that's pretty low. There's still pretty low cross-reactivity between the penicillins and cephalosporins. Certainly, if we think we're amoxicillin allergic, we're probably going to be avoiding most the penicillins for the time being. But in the most recent practice parameters that came out for drug allergy in 2022, if it was a unverified, non-anaphylactic, so even if it was urticaria, we would consider, or hives, we would consider that non-anaphylactic, you could go with any of the cephalosporins and give that to them. If you were concerned about an anaphylactic reaction to amoxicillin, you could avoid certain cephalosporins, generally in the first and second generation class. And there's a really good cross-reactivity chart in the Practical Evaluation of Drug Hypersensitivity PDF, which I always refer to because I'm not going to memorize all of these. I did write some of them down for you guys, but I'll say them. But in general, you're okay to use third, fourth, and fifth generation cephalosporins. So going to Ceftonir, for example, if you want to for an ear infection or something, you could also use azithromycin. They're totally fine with macrolides. But for the first generation ones, you want to think about cefadroxil and ceproxil, which is a second generation. They have identical side chains as amoxicillin. And then cefaclor, cefamandel, cefalexin, and cefradrine have similar side chains. I can't say any of these. But again, that's for anaphylactic reactions to amoxicillin, which for most kids, they really just have hives. And so you could get away with really doing any of those if you needed to. Even in our pregnant patients that are, this is for the older people, hopefully you aren't dealing with any in your pediatrics clinic. But if they are penicillin allergic and GBS positive, we can do cefazolin. And that's usually what our go-to will be, just so that we don't have to worry about challenging while they're still pregnant.
You know, we kind of actually covered each of these pieces for, food and seasonal allergies. So say we think this is an amoxicillin IgE-mediated reaction, like Chris said, even though this case is very consistent with the type 4, we refer them to you. Do you do similar skin prick stuff with all different types of penicillins and things like that? Or is the story good enough?
Usually the story is good enough up front, but after if a time period has passed, so a lot of people are coming to me, they already have that amoxicillin allergy labeling on their chart. And they're like, oh, it was when I was 10 months old, or it was when she was 10 months old. She's now 5 and her only reaction was hives. I'm just going to direct challenge her in clinic to amoxicillin. I'm not going to do skin testing. And they actually recommend against skin testing for kids that have only had cutaneous symptoms because there is a risk of false positives with that. It is invasive. And most in the studies they did up to 95, 96, even more percent passed their subsequent challenges to amoxicillin after 5 years.
And is there anything that we should know about drug allergy testing that you would do that's different than the food and environmental allergens?
Yeah. So the big difference is you do have intradermal testing. So you have that prick, which is the scratch, and that's what you're going to have for food, environmental, and for the drug. But then in addition with the drug, you're going to have that kind of that needle that goes slightly under the skin. They create a little bleb. If you've ever had a TB test done, that's kind of what it is. And it's multiple ones of those. So it's not without its discomfort for kids. And that's why we try as much as we can not to do that type of skin testing on the kiddos.
Okay, we've made great progress and learned a lot. So at this point, are there any main take-home points that you have for our listeners today?
Yeah, I think one is when in doubt, it is okay to refer to the allergist. We're here for you guys. We love to see our patients in allergy clinic, and so we're happy to see them for you if you have any questions or concerns about food, environmental, asthma, eczema, insect, drug, there's so many different things. I think too, is you guys are really the first line for your pediatric patients. You're seeing them a lot more often than I probably or another allergist gets to see them. And so getting that, feeling really comfortable with your counseling of patients, especially thinking about food introductions or food allergy problems when they're younger, and getting your chalk talk together and really having that be the same for every patient, getting really comfortable with your epinephrine auto-injector counseling, and so that you can help guide that patient until they can see an allergist. Food panel testing, no, please. And then for drug allergy, it's very common for amoxicillin to cause issues. Most of the time, it's not a true allergy. In a lot of cases, you can use that drug again and not have it be labeled. Hope we got the take-home points there.
That was awesome. I had a great time. I learned so much. I'm sure our listeners learned a lot as well. So before you go, I appreciate you spending so much time with us. Is there anything you want to plug? Are there any websites, any societies people should check out? You want to encourage people to become pediatric allergists? Like, what do you want to plug?
Definitely become an allergist. It's amazing. I was going to say some good patient resources, and I think I'm just passionate about food allergy, and so I think about that. But I think as a pediatrician, knowing about the FAIR network and the FAIR website, foodallergy.org, has amazing things for parents about how to take care of your child with a food allergy, the caregivers that are going to take care of your child, what questions should you be asking, how do you travel with a kid with food allergy. It just has a wealth of information. There is an FPIES organization too for food protein induced enterocolitis, which we didn't do a lot of talking about, but it's a huge problem for people and not a lot of physicians know about it, especially in rural areas. And so the more we can get that out and know more about it, the better.
We're going to have to do an advanced episode talking about that stuff.
Yeah, I'm down for it.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. This was amazing.
Thanks for having me, y'all. This was fun.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer, Dr. Olivia Baggett, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
This has been Olivia Baggett.
And this has been Chris the Chew Man Chew. Thank you and good night. And if you made it all the way to the end, I have another poem written by AI. This is one that I didn't even read beforehand. I had it generated in the background, so we're going to enjoy this one together. It's titled Whispers of Spring. In the quiet hum of a bustling clinic, where small sneezes echo like whispers of spring, tiny patients with eyes like dewy petals come seeking solace from the season's embrace. Spring brings gifts wrapped in pollen, a bouquet of bees, a trial for the young. Children with noses like leaky faucets and breaths like wheeze, like rusty gates, find refuge here. With a gentle hand, I offer tiny tablets, elixirs to tame the wilderness of an immune response, gone awry in the face of harmless invaders. We chart courses through fields of grass, armored with inhalers and antihistamines, ready to reclaim the outdoors from the grip of invisible foes. Together, we learn the language of bodies, interpreting the signs of rebellion, teaching tolerance one allergen at a time, so that spring can be a season not of dread, but of delight. That was wonderful.
That was beautiful. We'll have to give that to Jess and have her print it for her clinic.
I'll see you guys later. Bye.
Bye.